All right, we're starting. Thursday, January 19th, 2017. This is the Hermetic Hour. I'm your host, Poke Runyon, and tonight we review and discuss the 1934 horror classic, Creep Shadow Creep, by fantasy grandmaster Abraham Merritt. Now, this forgotten tale has influenced such modern films and TV shows as Dark Shadows and recently Outlander. It deals with a family feud that carries on for thousands of years between reincarnating ancestors of two ancient Breton Celtic clans, the Lord of Karnak and the royal family of the legendary sunken city of Ys. In their present 1930s incarnations, an anthropologist specializing in the occult, like Indiana Jones, and a psychiatrist specializing in hypnotic age regression, with a beautiful daughter who was and is a reincarnating evil soul-stealing witch. This story was the second in a series of such tales by Merritt, being the sequel to Burn, Witch, Burn, 1934, which was made into a film with Lionel Barrymore and influenced both Twilight Zone and the Chucky series. So, if you want to discover the roots of ancient evil surviving in the deep mind, tune in and we'll explore the dark world of the creeping shadows. Now, before getting into this evening's subject, I would like to call attention to previous Hermetic Hour reviews on Abraham Merritt and his work, which you can access, download, and enjoy on our Blog Talk Radio website. So get your pencils ready. I'll count from 1 to 10. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10. And now you have your pencils. On June 26, 2014, we aired a show called Abraham Merritt, Grandmaster of Magical Fantasy, which you can find on page 14 on the website. And then on June 9th, 2016, we aired Decoding the Moon Pool, which is archived on page number 4. And Decoding the Moon Pool is not listed if you do a search on Abraham Merritt, but you'll find it on page number 4 down there in the page blocks. Now, with these references duly noted, let us proceed with Creep Shadow Creep. As you may already know, Abraham Merritt, one of America's highest paid journalists, was also an amateur archaeologist and folklorist, a world traveler with a huge library of books on archaeology, folklore, and the occult. His stories often involve heroes who are reincarnations of ancient Celtic or Norse warriors. And in this tale, he exploits the ancient Celtic druidic belief that reincarnation followed the bloodlines of the family or the clan down through the ages. And in this case, he combines two legendary features of ancient Brittany on the west coast of France, known as Armorica or Gaul in Roman times. Now, two adjacent seacoast promontories, the prehistoric monoliths of Karnak and the sunken city or castle of Ys, which is spelled Y-S and pronounced Ys. The anthropologist is Alan Karnak, and he is the familial reincarnation of Alain de Karnak, Alain, A-L-A-I-N, de Karnak, the tribal chieftain of a Celtic clan that inhabits the area of the ancient Karnak monoliths. And he is the vassal of the royal family of the seacoast city of Ys. Alan Karnak was and will be again the last lover of Lady Dahu. That's spelled D-A-H-U-T, it's pronounced Dahu. The White Witch of Ys is the daughter of its king, now both of whom have reincarnated in the form of the psychiatrist, Dr. de Caradal, and his bewitchingly beautiful daughter. Who, in her ancient embodiment, was said to have murdered all of her lovers except the last one, who so beguiled her that she gave him her father's key to the sea gates of the city, which he unlocked and flooded, drowning them all. And of course, the city of Ys was below the sea level, and we'll discuss the legend of Ys further on. Now, in Mara's retelling of the legend, her last lover was Alain de Karnak. And like Perseus came to Medusa, he came to free his people from paying a blood tribute of human sacrifice to the Druidic witch cult of Ys. And while Lady Dahu makes ghostly shadow slaves of her dead lovers, her father, the king and high priest, and de Caradel, feeds Alain de Karnak's people to a dark, soul-stealing god called the Gatherer. Now, in ancient times, de Caradel forced Alain de Karnak to participate in these horrific human sacrifices. Now, the mad Dr. de Caradel's ultimate goal, and that's here in the 1930s, of course, his ultimate goal is to physically manifest the Gatherer in this dimension and to rule the world as his human regent. And to this end, he is determined to hypnotically control Alan Karnak and again force him to aid in the sacrifices as part of his reenactment of the ancient rite. Now, in the modern world of the 1930s, Dr. de Caradel seeks to recreate this ancient environment, not in France, but on the Atlantic coast of Rhode Island. And to obtain funds for building such an expensive supernatural theme park, he uses his daughter's talents. She dispatches her shadows in the form of succubi to seduce wealthy bachelors and drive them to suicide after they have willed their fortunes to her father's nonprofit foundation. And it is not a coincidence that three of these victims are friends of Alan Karnak and his associate, the psychiatrist, Dr. Lowell. Now, at a dinner party arranged by Lowell, Alan Karnak, Dr. de Caradel, and his daughter begin their mental chess game, which Lady Dahu continues later in her New York apartment with Alan. Now, this scene owes much to Rider Haggard's She, as Dahu evokes the romance of a previous lifetime in Alan's vision. Alan Karnak reports to Dr. Lowe, and they take counsel. Alan will accept an invitation from the DeCaradels to visit their seaside retreat in Rhode Island. Lowe arranges with the Ricori Mafia family that he has affiliated with in the previous story. That's Burnwich Burn. And the mafiosos will provide reconnaissance and backup for Alan's visit. Ricori's lieutenant is a Texas cowboy named McCann, who visits the neighborhood and returns with a detailed report. And he swaps Alan's 32 caliber automatic for a more powerful .380, and briefs the anthropologist on the surveillance he has established. McCann also has discovered the modern source of the DeCaradel's human sacrifice victims, a Depression-era poverty farm with several hundred inmates is adjacent to DeCaradel's acreage, and several of the inmates have already gone missing. Armed with this information and McCann's gun, Alan meets Lady Dahu at the marina, and they sail on to DeCaradel, and they sail on DeCaradel's yacht to the New Yeast Estate. I keep wanting to pronounce it Yeast, but it's pronounced Yeast. Once there, Alan plays another mental chess game with the master hypnotist, Dr. DeCaradel, and his seductive daughter. He is lured, drugged, and seduced into an illusory dream world where he relives his ancient participation in the human sacrifices. Now, this is a preparation for manipulating him into participating in DeCaradel's modern reenactment. Dahu competes with her father to dominate Alan. She hypnotizes him into her shadowland, but the love of Alan's girlfriend, Helen, reaches out across the miles into his mind and saves him from Dahu's spells. And he wakes, comes to his senses, from his sleepwalking dream world at the Cairn of the Sacrifices, where DeCaradel and his daughter are feeding the last of the blood to the materializing dark god. But just as the gatherer is about to take physical form, lightning flashes down, and an offshore earthquake raises a huge tidal wave that crashes down on the cairn and the new castle of East, drowning DeCaradel and his daughter just as they were drowned 2,000 years before. Now, if we need a moral to this story, we might say, in retrospect, that DeCaradel's experiment was more successful than even he imagined it would be, as he manifested both the god of darkness and the god of light almost simultaneously. Now, of course, the most important aspect of this story, at least from a magical hermetic point of view, is the connection of hypnosis and magic and the theme of hypnotic age regression. Now, as we have noted, this story has influenced numerous later works, such as Dark Shadows and the TV series Outlander. It is also followed by Poole and Karen Anderson's three-decker novel, The King of East, 1986. But Merritt's book also has its predecessors, The Demoiselle de East, From the King in Yellow by Robert Chambers, 1895, and, as mentioned above, Rider Haggard's She, 1887. Now, before we get into the legend of E. Sam Carnac, which we'll deal with, I'd like to mention that the nature of the sacrifices. These people, both in ancient times and in Karnak, and this, by the way Merritt conceives this, it occurred almost before Christianity. We should point out that the monoliths at Karnak, the actual monoliths, are pre-Celtic. They're 7,000 years old. This is one of the oldest formations extant. Of course, there are some recently discovered over in Turkey that are older, but this is 7,000. This is before these stones at Karnak were raised before the pyramids of Egypt, and they were pre-Celtic. But, of course, naturally, when the Celts came in and the Druids, they appropriated them. And we are to assume, of course, that Alain de Karnak and his clan were Celts. And of course, de Caradel and his daughter, de Hu, they're also Celts and Druidic. These sacrifices that were supposedly made at the cairn down by the sea, at the terminus of the monoliths. Now the monoliths in Karnak are different than Stonehenge in over in England, all the same period, but they're different in that they march in a column, of twos. Over miles down to the sea, where there's this rock formation where the sacrifices supposedly took place. Now, we'll get into some of the legends about the stones a little bit further on. But according to Merritt, these human sacrifices that were made down at the cairn. They took the victim and put them on the altar and crushed the chest with a stone maul, a hammer. And crushed the chest, and the blood flowed, of course, into a vessel, which they you know, was the offering. Now, quite frankly, I can find no reference. I can't find a reference in the Golden Bough. I can't find a reference in Lewis Spence's 1917 book on the Druids. I can't find a reference anywhere to that kind of a sacrifice in connection with the Celts. And I asked my esteemed colleague Anne Finnan, who is the gracious lady of the Roebuck, and our number one Celtic Wicca clan, and she is an authority on Celtic rituals and superstitions and that sort of thing, and Anne couldn't remember anything like that in anything she's studied. On Celtic sacrifices. So I don't know where Merritt got this. And if anybody out there listening knows where Merritt was a very good researcher. So I think it must have been something that somebody must have dug up some skeletons with a rib cage crushed or something like that. He gave Merritt the idea of this. And we also should mention, though, of course, that as we said before, that the stones at Karnak are pre-Celtic. They really are pre-Druidic, just like Stonehenge is pre-Druidic. But they were appropriated, of course, by the Druids, obviously. So we don't really know where he got this idea for crushing the chests. Of course, the Druids did human sacrifice, and mostly though that they sacrificed prisoners of war or criminals or whatever. And you all recall the Wicker Man, of course, you know, and usually sacrifices were done that way. But this is the Karnak legend, and the legend of Ys of the Sunken City are two separate legends of Brittany, which merit combined in this story. Let's explore the legend of the legend of Ys. The legend of Ys is fascinating. It kind of relates to Atlantis, and it represents a phenomenon that along that coast, the coast of both the coast of England and the coast of France, that repeats itself over and over again. The tides, for one thing, the tides in that area are extreme, and they have extreme tides, like the Bay of Fundy, you know, these extreme tides, and quite often, as Anne was explaining to me the other night, that castles were built out on these promontories, and often they were built on islands where the promontory had the promontory ended with sort of an island, and at high tides the road over to the castle was flooded, and there's several of these monasteries and castles. And Ys was probably one of the earliest of this type, but it was probably built, if it is as old as the legend indicates, it was probably built back when the sea level was actually lower. And, you know, as we know, 12,000 years ago, you could walk from Paris to Dublin and not get your feet wet because the sea level was quite a bit lower. And so if Ys was in fact built back around, in the beginning of the Neolithic, or what we call the Neolithic, around 12,000 years ago, then it could have been built. And then like Atlantis, they could have kept, as the sea level began to rise and the ice melted, and the sea level began to rise. Global warming. As the sea level began to rise, they began to build these dikes around around the city. The same thing that happened to Atlantis, and then all it takes, is one bad storm or an earthquake, and your city's flooded. And the interesting thing about these is that here you have these sea gates. Well, now this is the sea gate, as Paul Anderson points out, is not a modern canal lock. Now, in modern times, and here again I'm falling back on Paul Anderson, in modern times you have locks that control the levels of water, like in the Panama Canal and what have you. But they didn't have that kind of technology back then. And so what it's described, although we don't think they did, but then maybe we really don't know, because according to the legend of Ys, they had these elaborate bronze gates in the dike, and the king of Ys had the key, and he kept it around his neck, and so if he wanted to, he could open up the three gates and flood the city if he chose to do that. He had the key. Now, here again, according to legend, his daughter, the Who, the White Witch, she was kind of like Bluebeard or the king in Scheherazade, who she kept taking these lovers and tiring of them and murdering them and enslaving their ghosts. She was a ghost slaver, and as we all know, ghost slaving is one of the most evil forms of black magic. And she was one of the original ghost slavers. And then finally, one lover of hers was so hard to get. He played so hard to get. He wouldn't kiss her. He played hard to get to the point where she became absolutely obsessed with him, and to win his love. And he, according to legend, told her, "Well, if you get me the key to the sea gates, then I will share my love with you." So she did. And sure enough, he opened the sea gates and flooded the city because the city was evil, and he was, she was just one of several witch queens that dominated the city, and so flooded the city. And her father, she and her father tried to ride out on horseback, but the road got flooded. They got drowned. There's a famous painting of that. If you go on Wikipedia, you'll see the painting, the Flight of King Grodleon by E.V. Lumineis, 1884, and shows the king and he's in the surf being falling off the horse and being drowned. And that was the legend. And connecting it with Karnak, which is another promontory in Brittany, was Merritt's idea. The first reincarnation of the demoiselle, the Ys, that's the Who. That was the first story. Was written by Robert Chambers back in 1885, and it was one of the stories in a collection of stories of his called The King in Yellow, which, as most of us know, was quite an influence on H.P. Lovecraft, and of course, obviously, also an influence on Merritt, and because this is about a young man who art student who goes down to the coast in Brittany and finds an old chateau and encounters the demoiselle Ys in her incarnation at the time, and we have this. Time warp story, and Merritt was obviously influenced by that, but Merritt's own imagination connected Karnak with Ys. He put the legends together. Now let's talk a little bit about Karnak. Karnak is one of the most amazing Neolithic ruins. like Stonehenge, and it's about from the same period. You have heard, or you must have heard, about prehistoric Stonehenge alignment in England, mysterious solar clock, or maybe a lunar calendar, simply a burial ground. We don't know for sure to this day. I want to tell you about the menhirs and dolmens in good old Brittany in France. The erected granite stones found in several places in the salted land, with the most prominent ones seen in Karnak, and they're older than Stonehenge, which is 4,500 BC versus 3,000. You know, they're older than Stonehenge, 4,500 BC versus 3,000 BC. The legend wants the giant Karnak stones to be the stuff of enchantment and superstitions. The dense collection of megalithic rocks includes dolmens, menhirs, tumuli, and other alignments. Menhir is a word in the Breton language that means long stone, mean stone, and her meaning long. Some 3,000 tall stones, I get this, some 3,000 tall stones erected 7,000 years ago at Karnak. By the pre-Celtic people of Brittany, it is unclear why the story of St. Cornelius turning pagan soldiers of Rome into stones, or why the wizard Merlin was also possibly responsible for entire Roman legions to be turned to stone, as both these happenstances would have been no older than the first century. For those familiar with Merlin, he was a good wizard in the Arthurian, King Arthur legend, and even though he was allegedly born in Britain, he died and was buried in Brittany. Was Merlin a real person? The fog over Brittany will never reveal such a secret. But in the history of that part of France, Merlin was sometimes a holly tree and sometimes a wise man. The forest of Brocklandy in Brittany was often used as a site of magical happenings involving several legendary wizards and fairies, as well as some of King Arthur's knights of the Round Table, working undercover to assure the pursuit of the Holy Grail and the preservation of peace. In Arthurian times, Brittany was not yet part of France, but was its own kingdom, sometimes even considered a colony of Britain, as many Britons came to settle there. In France, England is also called Grande Bretagne, which means Great Brittany. Great Britain. Interesting. Druids in Brittany were real and were the medicine men of their time. They roamed the land of pines, roses, and wild lavender, scavenging roots and flowers to make special potions and ointments from the products of the earth. And with the power to heal and to treat the mystical side, it's easy to imagine surrounding such creatures. Brittany is very much filled with myths and fairy tales, with sentiment of knowing that none of it can be the truth. The oral traditions are stronger in Brittany than history books, and the deep forest of the lands are very good at hiding facts. Some of the rock formations clearly look like massive tables, or perhaps just shelters. Were they used for sacrifices? Maybe a goat or two saw their final moment flash in front of their eyes while lying on the cold stones in the darkness. A tragic moonless night. My grandparents had a small dolmen in their backyard, and they used to tell us kids that it was a sacred stone where you could lay one hand and solemnly make a wish to your, of your desire. I have many unfulfilled wishes waiting for that particular stone to make them happen. If these dolmens were tombs, the acidic soil of Brittany has long eaten away the human bones. The dolmens are usually made of several standing stones capped by a flat top laying on the legs. and some of them were gigantic monuments, such as the Kunkunul Dolmen, a 40-ton semi-flat table stone about 25 feet, supported by 5-foot-11-inch high pillars. Smaller stones in perfect alignment remind the eye of a modern cemetery. But the fact that no bones are left makes it impossible to confirm the true meaning of the strange stones, as if they were indeed graves. Why only at a few special spots in the province of Brittany? Why not all over the country? Ireland, England, France, and India all have well-documented such stones. They're probably all tombstones. Was it a way to preserve bodies from the harsh elements to have them buried under such heavy stones? But the mystery of how such heavy stones were moved around and aligned in sometimes perfect symmetry remains an unexplained phenomenon. The remarkable alignment of Karnak is unique in the world, and even though it might not be as famous as Stonehenge, it remains an eerie, beautiful mark of our ancestors' prints on the earth. Well, now, Karnak, as I said, the stones march in column down to the sea. And another legend says that each one of these stones has a shadow attached to it. Now, the main thing that in Creep Shadow Creep that is of considerable importance magically, as I say, in Hermetic tradition, is this idea of hypnotic age regression. And because those of you who have experienced, path workings and the magical lodge, you know that we do this. We do age regression. It's something that we do in the OTA, of course, and we go back and take the soul back as far as good. I don't really know how much of this, these previous lifetimes, whether they're followed by bloodline or whether they are followed, they come out of the Akashic record. I don't know how. I am not going to venture an opinion, but I will say that this idea of ancestral reincarnation has a great deal of anecdotal evidence to support it. And people have had psychedelic experiences that confirm this, that you carry your ancestors with you. And this belief is not just a belief of the ancient Druids. It's a belief in many parts of the world, and many different cultures. Now, in Creep Shadow Creep, Merritt, who is a very talented writer, he manages to get to picture, to bring to life the dream world of this shadow world of the Sukubi and the ghosts of these sacrificial victims, and this is what I think is the part of the story that is the most powerful, is this dreamscape that the witch Dahu is able to inflict upon her victims. And as we said in the the review, she sends out her shadows that she controls to, in the form of Sukubi, to seduce these wealthy victims, and then she herself meets them socially, and she gets them to leave their money to her father's nonprofit foundation. And of course, what they're trying to do is use that money to replicate the Standing Stones and the Cairn of Sacrifice, to replicate it just as it in the same pattern as Karnak, and then they have a mansion that they have converted into a castle, very much like that of East. And de Caradel's experiment, that he calls it an experiment, is if he can make this replication, and then he uses these poor homeless victims of the American Depression, who are on a poverty farm right adjacent to his land, and he uses them as his victims, and he believes that if he does this ritual exactly the way it was done, that he can bring the same dark god into manifestation. And of course, as the story goes, he virtually succeeds in doing this, but he manages to manifest the god of darkness, but at the same time he brings down the wrath of the god of light. This is kind of a Deus Ex Machina ending, in a sense. I thought the way this thing was going, that Ricori and his mafioso soldiers were going to end up coming in and shooting up the ceremony with Tommy guns. That was the way you think it's going to end, but that's not the way it ends. As a matter of fact, when the tidal wave hits, Ricori's gangsters are down there on the beach, and they're prepared to make the assault, but they're drowned. They're drowned along with Dahu and de Caradel. And so in this sense, Ricori and his mafiosi, they sort of end up providing sacrifices themselves. It's the story is very, very evocative and very fascinating. It would make a very, very interesting film. I think a more interesting film than its predecessor, Burn, Witch, Burn. Which now in Burn, Witch, Burn, the villainess was a witch, Madame de Lepe, who made little devil dolls. These little devil dolls were animated, and they actually attacked their victims, and as I said, this influenced the Twilight Zone episode, which also in turn influenced the Chucky series, the little deadly little dolls, and that thing's been used before, but this is nowhere near as sinister and effective as Dahu and her ghost slaving with her shadows. And quite frankly, I think that Creep Shadow Creep is a real classic of American horror, and equal to anything Lovecraft came up with, and in the same venue, and it kind of reminds you a little bit of the case of Charles Dexter Ward, and frankly I'd strongly recommend it if you like merit, and of course I encourage you, you all, to go and search out our other shows on Abraham Merritt and reviewing his other works like The Ship of Ishtar and The Moon Pool and the Dwellers in the Mirage, which is another one about reincarnating ancient warrior and human sacrifices to an interdimensional demon, which is a theme that Merritt was particularly good at. And as far as acquiring a copy of Creep Shadow Creep, you're going to have to settle at this point for an old pulp magazine copy. I have one, and there's several different old pulp magazine copies of it available, you know, from Amazon and Libris and whatever. So you can and inexpensive. Merritt's books were very, very popular, so there's a lot of reprints available from back in the 30s. They're still available and readable, so you can get them. And I strongly, as I said, I strongly recommend it. Wraps it up. So until next week. Good magic, and we'll see you next week. Bye-bye.